Morris Stratton, Reel 5.
The course at Sealand was divided into two parts. And the first part was very roughly similar to the one we'd done at Filton when we flew on Tiger Moths. The big difference, of course, being that it was on service aircraft. Now, I was chosen to learn on twin-engined aircraft, so I then knew at that time that I was destined for bombers. I wasn't particularly thrilled about this, but as a result of my various examinations, it had become obvious that maths was my strong point, and also too at Filton I'd done well in the written examinations that we had in the navigation examination, and the policy was that they wanted navigation for the bombers because they had to fly distances. So I was, with several others, chosen to fly on these twin-engined Oxfords. They were new aircraft at Sealand, and none of the instructors had ever flown them before. So before they could set us to fly them, they had to learn to fly themselves. And a new sort of policy had to be worked out for teaching pupils on twin-engined aircraft, because of course the technique is different from flying single-engined aircraft. But these problems and teething troubles were sorted out, and my course was the guinea pig course. We had to put up with it, and we all did this course and got used to them. They seemed rather big and clumsy after a little tiger moth, what appeared to be rather a big, clumsy twin-engined aircraft, but one got used to them, and I enjoyed flying them after a time. In fact, they were quite a good aircraft to fly.
Did you feel that you were guinea pigs while you were up in the air under instruction?
Oh yes, because we knew that from the conversation of the different instructors, they had only got possibly 3 and 4 hours flying on them, and they were trying to teach us. And some of the instructors had never flown a twin-engined aircraft before themselves. Oh yes, we knew it all right.
But were any of the instructors still having problems themselves flying them?
Not as far as I know. No, from my own experience later on, it's really like riding a bicycle. Once you've ridden a bicycle, you'll ride a bicycle. It doesn't matter how big or heavy or awkward it is, you'll still ride it. It's a technique that you have learned, and the more experienced, and of course the flying instructors were very experienced, they soon were in a position to be able to teach us.
Can you remember how big the group of you was that were actually at sea?
Yes, there were 37 of us altogether. There were 11 of us who were airmen, training to be sergeant pilots, and the other 26 were civilians, or ex-civilians, who had short service commissions as acting pilot officers. At this time, the expansion of the Air Force had started, and the Air Force was trying to get as many young officers as possible in as short a time as possible to keep pace with the rapid growth of the German Air Force.
What was your attitude to this influx of new officers?
The attitude of me and of the rest of us was that we'd had a rough deal. We, all well-educated, ex-grammar school boys, had come in to the Air Force when the Depression was on, when there were just no jobs at all, and we'd had to fight and struggle and have a really tough existence in the Air Force, in the ranks, to attain what we had. And at the end of it, we should still only be sergeants, whereas these youngsters, just because of fate, had been able to step in, many of them with qualifications far less than we had. And there was, if anything, we rather looked down on them. They were referred to as Sainsbury boys, as though they were ex-grocer's assistants.
And presumably you had one mess and they had another one.
Oh yes, sir, they were messed in the officer's mess. And we were still in the airman's mess, yes. Although, I mean, one couldn't compare it, shall we say, with Ryslip. It was a vast difference. There's a tremendous difference between commissioned and non-commissioned ranks in the fighting services, and we felt it, and we felt that it was an injustice. I still think it is, or think it was.
So the second part of the training was at Sealand was in being instructed in the service type, the Oxford, and then what was the second term at Sealand, the final part of the training? What
now, at the end of the first term, we were recognised as qualified pilots, and at the end of that term, we were all given our pilot's brevet. We had our wings, and very proud of them we were. Although we weren't promoted sergeant at that time, we weren't fully trained in as much as we had not done the training, the military part of the training. That had to come in the third term, when we would learn bombing and air firing and reconnaissance and all the other different aspects of military flying. But we'd done everything as regards flying an aircraft proficiently, a military aircraft proficiently. And therefore, there were people, LACs, and I myself by this time, I was a corporal, walking around with sporting our wings. Second part, as I said, was all aspects of military flying. Bombing, that was done at some bombing ranges down on the tip of North Wales, beyond Pwllheli, at some bombing ranges known as Hell's Mouth. We used to go down there. And the air firing, that was done over the sea, if it was air-to-air, when one aircraft would tow a drogue behind and the other aircraft would fire at it. And if it was air-to-ground, it would be done over the firing range at Hell's Mouth. We flew in pairs because by this time, of course, as we were all qualified pilots, we could take passengers. In fact, a wireless operator used to come along too, and there used to be three in the aircraft. Two pupils, myself and my partner, and the wireless operator on the wireless set. And we should act as pilot, turn and turn about. Whilst I piloted the aircraft, he would either do the bombing or the air firing, and vice versa. And that was how this practical military side of the training was carried out. And of course, we did cross-country flights too, and reconnaissance and that sort of thing.
What sort of accuracy could you personally achieve when it came to the bombing, first of all?
Very good when it was artificial bombing. Not so good when it was with real bombs. Now, the artificial bombing was done with what is known as camera obscura, whereby really it was taking a photograph with a camera from the aircraft. It was quite a complicated affair, but it had its uses. But as I say, one could get good results on that, but when it came to the real thing, because of the conditions such as airspeed, and wind speed and direction, then the air bomb invariably landed from a different place from where it was aimed.
So the camera obscura wasn't really a very fair test?
Not except under ideal climatic conditions and that sort of thing.
And what about the other part, the air firing? How did you get on with that?
Oh, very well. Very well, it was something I used to enjoy. Although after my training, of course, I never used it at all. Never used the gun, because the air firing consisted of being in the turret at the back and firing at, a drogue that was being towed, or on the ground at a stationary target on the ground from the turret. The rear of the aircraft. But the people on the ground, the armourers, they could tell how well you did by counting up the number of holes in the drogue or on the ground, and the results were usually quite good.
So, when it came to the end of your time at Sealand, you then were required to do further specialisation in the navigation aspect.
Yes, not all who had trained on Twiddens I'm not absolutely sure of this. Oh yes, all of us who had trained on Twiddens, all of us, we went down to the School of Navigation at Manston in Kent. It was a large school for navigation, and we did a very, very comprehensive navigation course there. All aspects of navigation, including meteorology. Very good instructors, and there was far more time that was spent in the air than in the classroom. It was a very, very good course. And we used Ansons, and they are a very good roomy aircraft for learning navigation. There's quite a good table, and there's a good lookout all round it. They were very good. We used to fly along the Channel, Thames Estuary, up the North Sea, across England, across the Irish Sea. It was a very, very good course. That lasted 10 weeks, that course did. And of the, I can't remember how many who were on that course, but I suppose it would be about 25 of us, I should think. But two of us, no, five of us. Two sergeants, myself and a Sergeant Best, and, no, three of us, sorry, two sergeants and one acting pilot officer were chosen to stay behind on an astronomical navigation course that was commencing. And we were joined by another nine experienced pilots who'd been selected from various squadrons in Bomber Command to do this astronomical navigation course, which was all night flying and lasted 5 weeks.
And just moving forward a little bit, how, when you had to put these techniques into practice in the actual wartime conditions, how did you find that these courses stood up to the test of war?
The straightforward navigation course, very, very well indeed. Given the information, the meteorological information that we had, that was, of course, lacking at times, because the Met Office didn't have access to any Met stations on the continent after the fall of France. And so when we were doing trips over Germany after the fall of France, it was a hit and miss business regarding Met forecasts. And also too, in those days we had radio silence, so we couldn't get the benefit of radio fixes. It wasn't easy at all. But with those two exceptions, the navigation course was extremely good, the main navigation course. Now, the astro course would have been very, very good in any aircraft other than the Hampden. But the astro navigation, of course, depends entirely on the bubble sextant, and the holding of the bubble sextant in the Hampden is not very practical at all. So it wasn't too good. But I myself, I didn't have to apply astronomical navigation. Whilst I was a navigator with Flight Lieutenant Leroy as his second pilot, I never had any navigation troubles, and we did, I think it was 17 trips together, and all, some of them very, very long ones to Norway, and all over sea, where you do have to be accurate. But we flew accurately, even on the Met information we had. And then when I was a captain myself, the various navigators that I had, they were all pilots, their navigation, although they might necessarily not have done a navigation course, their navigation on of their pilot's course stood them in good stead, because I always was able to get back all right and find the target and that sort of thing.
In May 1939, you finished your navigation course, and you were then posted to 49 Squadron at Scampton. Were you, at that stage, a sergeant, fully-fledged sergeant pilot?
Oh, yes, I had been since leaving Sealand. Yes, the course at Manston, although I was a student, a navigation student, I was still a pilot. Well, and although I did know actual piloting of aircraft, I was a sergeant and accommodated in the sergeant's mess, etc. Yes.
What did you find, first of all, when you actually arrived at Scampton?
Oh, it's that was quite an experience, in as much as the squadron were away. They were up in Scotland on some summer exercises, and there was only a very, very tiny skeleton staff on the squadron. Another flying officer and myself were the only two pilots, and we had a good time between us. A lot of the time I spent at home, and there was an ensign that belonged to the squadron that I used to fly about quite a bit to keep my hand in on flying. Yes, I enjoyed myself very much. That went on for several weeks until the squadron came back.
And what were the planes that the main squadron, the squadron was equipped with?
The squadron was equipped with the Hamdens. They were a bomber, quite an effective bomber for those days. It had a top speed, I think, of 257. It took a 2,000-pound bomb load, which was, I think, a bigger bomb load than either the Whitley or the Wellington, which were the other two big bombers of Bomber Command. They were the biggest aircraft of Bomber Command of those days. It was long before the four-engined aircraft. It was very, very manoeuvrable. The only trouble with the Hamden, of course, was that it was so confined as regards space. When the pilot was in his seat, he was stuck there from when he took off until he landed again. The aircraft was only as wide as the pilot's seat. There were a narrow, very narrow fuselage with a pencil-like boom, and it had got a long range too, in a duration of at least 10 hours. It could be stretched to 12 hours. So when the pilot was in his seat and he was doing a trip to Norway or to Berlin or to Leipzig or somewhere like that, he knew that he'd got to make arrangements if he'd take the pint of beer before he took off.
Did you have any problems adjusting to flying the Hamden?
No. As I say, I'd kept my hand in with the Anson, and although the Anson is a gentle little thing, beautiful to fly, very easy, although it's a twin-engine aircraft. I went to the squadron leader soon after the squadron returned from Scotland, said, well, we'd better get you away solo as quickly as possible. And he said, you better come up behind me and I'll keep shouting out what I'm doing. We'll do that for three or four landings and then you'll have to take it up yourself. And that's just what happened. I had no difficulty, although it was a very much higher aircraft than I'd ever flown before. The pilot's seat was, I suppose, his eyes were about 10 feet above the ground, which is a fair height compared with the Tiger Moth, when it was possibly about 4 feet.
Where did your first experience of night flying come into this whole series of different training exercises?
Oh, that was the first term at Sealand on Oxfords. We did no night flying at all on the ab initio course at Filton on Moths, but with the Oxford, yes. And we had to do a certain amount of night flying in both terms. The first term was taken up mostly with taking off and landing, but in the second term, then we had to do night triangular cross-country flights, fly to a certain point where we turn, shall we say, from Sealand. We might fly down to Bristol and turn for Birmingham, and then turn for back to turning places like that you can't possibly miss, because at this time, of course, all lights were on. And
did people ever miss them, in fact?
Yes, and there were quite a few casualties. Yes. I think I went on at least 3 funeral parties whilst I was at Sealand.
That was all as a result of night accidents?
No, not always, no. In fact, to kind of think of it, I don't recall a night accident now. Most of the accidents were climbing turns after takeoff. They were very frequent, and invariably they just span straight in.
In those last 2 months at Scampton, before the war broke out, what was the atmosphere like in the squadron there?
Happy-go-lucky. I don't think anybody, or not many people except possibly super optimists, had any illusions at all about inevitable war. But the feeling was, I think, there'll be war and there'll be lots and lots of casualties, but it won't be me. I think that was the feeling. I don't remember any despondency. I think that if anything, it was